A generation of Americans got used to hearing about antimatter from TV, usually in a Scottish accent. Scotty on Star Trek seemed to have something to say about matter-antimatter reactors every few episodes. Star Trek is fiction. Antimatter is not. And University of Oregon professor Jim Brow can explain what it is and what it does. He'll do so tomorrow night at 6 at the Eugene Library. We'll get a bit of a preview now. Jim Brow is the Philip H. Knight Professor at the University of Oregon Physics Department and director of the Oregon Center for High Energy Physics. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, Jim.
Good morning, Jeff. It's good to be with you again.
It's good to have you. Let's you do a bit of outreach. Tell us a little about the physics slams on the UO campus. I really like this idea.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've done that twice now, and they've been very popular, full houses both times, and it's been a lot of fun. We basically get a few of our faculty colleagues to present about a 10-minute presentation on some aspect of their research that's accessible for the general public, and then at the end of the event, we have a vote to decide which one of them did the best job. It's been a lot of fun.
We talked to you about a year and a half ago about dark matter. What fascinated you enough about physics to want to make a career out of it?
Well, I'm very curious about the universe. I would like to understand more and more about how it ticks and what the various aspects are of it. And I'm completely convinced that as we do understand the nature of the universe, we discover ways to put it to practical use.
I don't want to get too far down the road of strange things I talked about with my mother, but she's the one who told me that when matter and antimatter meet, there's a terrible explosion. Was Mom right?
Mom was right. You can consider Einstein's famous equation, E equals MC squared. E is the energy, M is the mass, and when mass and antimatter come together, their mass completely converts into energy.
So what is antimatter, then?
Well, antimatter is... basically, for every single fundamental particle that we're aware of, the electron is one, there is a partner antiparticle that's been discovered in nature. And the antimatter was actually predicted more than 80 years ago in the theory developed by Dirac to understand the nature of the electron. He was basically trying to unify quantum mechanics with relativity, taking a further step from the earlier version of quantum mechanics. And when he made that unification, bringing relativity into the role, he discovered that all of the electrons had to have matching negative energy states, is what he basically found. And over time, it turned out these so-called negative energy states were real particles, but basically antiparticles matching the real particles, the electron, for example.
And Dirac was a French physicist, is that right?
Dirac was. He's actually spent a lot of time in the UK. He finally moved to Florida. He passed away in Florida. He's buried in Florida. But there, in Westminster Abbey, there's a tribute to him, actually, as a result of his work in the UK.
What is it about understanding that there, A, is antimatter, and B, how it works that helps us understand the universe better?
Well, you know, the thing is, as we know the universe is about 13.8 billion years old. We've learned how to measure the age of the universe since the time of the Big Bang. And we know that is an absolute fact, and we know lots of things about the universe going way back in time. We think we know how the universe worked at the moment of creation, at the moment of the Big Bang. And we believe that what happened at that time was that we started out with basically lots of energy, and that energy turned into matter and antimatter. So if there were no antimatter, we never would have been able to create the matter of which we are made. So to me, it's the most fundamental question is our existence depends on the existence of antimatter.
So it, in a sense, it touched off the Big Bang?
It played a role in the creation of matter at the beginning of the Big Bang. Now, one of the interesting things is today the universe is only made out of matter. There is no remaining antimatter from the Big Bang. All the antimatter around us is created in the current era, either artificially by mankind or through natural processes like cosmic rays or astrophysical bodies that create large amounts of energy release. So that antimatter created at the origin of the Big Bang disappeared over time. And it's a very interesting physics question as to how we started out with equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the moment of the Big Bang, and over time that antimatter went away. We think we know a little bit about that, but there are still some of the details to be worked out.
Does antimatter have mass, or does it have anti-mass? I mean, how would we describe its tangible existence, if there is such a thing?
Well, this is a very interesting point. All of the mass of the antimatter particles are exactly the same as the mass of their matching particles. So the mass of the anti-electron, which we call the positron because it has positive charge, is exactly the same as the mass of the electron. And we measure those masses as precisely as we can, and we find that they, in fact, match. The same thing is true of the proton and the antiproton and the neutron and the antineutron. They all have exactly the same mass, but they have opposite charge. But one of the questions that comes up then is, does antimatter fall up or down? Well, normal matter falls down. Does antimatter fall up? And we actually have some evidence to show that is interesting, which I'll try to explain tomorrow night, that antimatter falls down just like matter. So in that respect, it behaves the same as matter.
Darn, there goes the anti-gravity hopes I was raising for a few seconds there. We're talking to Jim Brough, University of Oregon physics professor, director of the Oregon Center for High Energy Physics, about antimatter. He'll be talking about why antimatter matters tomorrow night at 6 until 7:30 at the Eugene Public Library. You can join our discussion now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone around the region or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Steve in Eugene, welcome to the Exchange with Dr. Jim Brough.
Howdy. So far we've got three types of matter, dark matter, antimatter, and the stuff we deal with daily. Is there a theoretical possibility for a dark antimatter?
Okay, so we got the dark matter and the antimatter in one potential existence there. Thanks for that, Steve. Jim, what do you say?
Well, the answer is absolutely. I mean, we know for a fact that matter and antimatter exists. We've studied those things in the laboratory all the time. And we think there's such a thing as dark matter, which we observe evidence for in astrophysical measurements, galaxy rotation curves and clusters of galaxies and the like. Well, our best understanding of this dark matter is that it would mimic matter in the sense that there would be dark matter particles and there would be anti-dark matter particles. Now, in the universe today, just like the fact that all the matter and has persisted and the antimatter has gone away, probably the amount of anti-dark matter left over from the Big Bang would be minimal or non-existent. And however, in the early universe, this stuff would have been created equally, just like matter and antimatter.
So it's not a very scientific term, I know, and I appreciate that, actually, to say that it's gone away, most of the antimatter in the universe. So what's the greatest suspicion about where or what happened to it?
Well, in most ways, matter and antimatter behave exactly the same way. They have the same mass. They have the same lifetimes for the unstable particles of matter and antimatter. But in particle physics experiments, we've measured small, subtle differences between matter and antimatter in the way they behave, in the way they interact with other particles and the like. So we can imagine, we haven't figured out exactly which one of these subtle differences is the source of this change. It may have something to do with the difference between neutrinos and antineutrinos in the early universe, but we do see some differences. And these differences can be translated into a situation where, because of the differences, a small excess of matter developed over the antimatter very early in the universe. A little more matter than antimatter came about. First there was equal amounts, then there was a slight difference. Then, as the universe cooled off, all the matter and antimatter annihilated, and that slight excess of matter was left behind because it couldn't completely annihilate. There was only so much antimatter around to annihilate it, and that small excess that developed because of these differences was left over, and that's what we're all made out of.
So, but generally, it's a zero-sum game. I mean, equal amounts of matter and antimatter will equal nothingness unless there's a little of one left over.
Yeah, and we've seen small differences between matter and antimatter that could have We haven't found the right answer. All of the differences we've found don't add up to enough difference to account for this universe we live in. But the fact that such things do exist lead us to believe that there must be another explanation. It could be in the neutrino sector. Experiments are going on right now at Fermilab to try to sort that all out. Or it could be in the dark matter sector, that the differences between the dark matter and the anti-dark matter in slight differences accounts for this excess of matter that's developed early in the universe, very, 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 very early, before the annihilation process had set in.
So, Jim, you mentioned that there's, with no antimatter left, that you find some in cosmic rays, and then, but you also mentioned that there's some that humans create. And we're talking about in particle accelerators and places like that?
Well, one of the best examples, I think, of this is the PET scanner,
mm-hmm.
is positron emission tomography. And basically what happens is people put tracers, radioactive sources. You know, antimatter is emitted by radioactive materials. For example, bananas are great sources of antimatter, it turns out.
Really?
There's potassium in bananas. Potassium has a small fraction of the elements, about one part in 10,000, which are radioactive. And, they produce anti-electrons, positrons. In fact, the average adult body has a positron being produced by the potassium in the body about every 40 seconds. So if you're healthy and have an average body, which I'm sure you do, then every minute there's an antimatter particle in your body produced by the decay of the potassium in your body. It immediately annihilates into two gamma rays. It finds an electron because, of course, your body is full of electrons. So when that positron is emitted by the radioactive decay of the potassium in your body, it then immediately annihilates with an electron in your body and turns into two gamma rays.
Jim Brouse, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, director of the Oregon Center for High Energy Physics. We're talking about antimatter. He'll be talking about that tomorrow night at 6 at the Eugene Library. Making my brain hurt here, but it's a good kind of hurt. So does the antimatter reaction with potassium also explain potassium's violent reaction with water, or is that a totally different thing?
I don't know. I think that's completely different.
Okay. I'm working into chemistry there, away from physics.
So now
about the antimatter and cosmic rays, where do cosmic rays begin and where are they going?
Well, the main the universe is mainly made out of hydrogen, which is protons and electrons, and the high-energy cosmic rays are mostly protons rushing through the universe. And when one of those protons strikes the upper atmosphere at a very high energy, it creates an interaction which can release energy and produce matter and antimatter in pairs. So down on the surface of the Earth, we have matter and antimatter produced in these pairs. The antimatter doesn't persist very long. It annihilates with matter and goes away, but we see it all the time. Another interesting thing is there's a set of people who've gone out looking at thunderstorms, and an article appeared in Nature recently where they've shown that positrons, the anti-electron, are actually created in thunderstorms. So that's another source of antimatter. Not very much, very, very little, but... Mm-hmm. Actually detect that antimatter coming out of thunderstorms. So you can imagine very large fields are created in those thunderstorms, which then, in principle, can convert the energy of particles that are accelerated in those fields into pairs of matter and antimatter.
So does that account for some of the energy released by thunderstorms?
Well, it's a very, very small fraction, very small fraction.
We have an email here from Jay in Walterville. He asks, is the dark and antimatter something you tangibly have for observations and experiments? Can you store it? Can I buy some?
Well, it's very rare. The amount of antimatter that was produced at Fermilab, it ran its Tevatron for almost 30 years, producing antiprotons for the collider there. And over that roughly 30-year period, they produced about a billionth of a gram of antimatter per year. So it only came up to a very small fraction of the amount of energy you'd need to make a source of energy. And then, of course, they immediately used it and annihilated it. How do you store this stuff? Well, people have been trying to solve that problem and think about it. In fact, NASA has even funded some investigations into figuring out how to store this elusive material. But the problem is, of course, as soon as it strikes the walls of any container, it immediately annihilates. So it's hard to imagine how this will be done, except in science fiction, it's great.
So it is still science fiction, then, to think of it in terms of the energy released, because if you could capture that energy, you could really be doing great things, it seems like.
Oh, absolutely. It's a tremendous potential energy source. It's just difficult to produce, very expensive, actually, when you think about how much it costs to produce this
sure.
stuff. It
mm-hmm.
turns out to be quite expensive. It's very difficult to produce. And then, how do you store it is a huge challenge. So it's not practical in any sense, and I don't imagine it will be for a very, very long time. But Star Trek and Angels and Demons and all these great fantasies make great use of the ideas.
They really do. Before you go, Jim, I know you teach a course in astronomy, and I just want to ask, given that we're all waiting for the pictures from Pluto, how anxiously you are awaiting the information from the New Horizon flyby.
Well, it's very exciting. I really admire the work that's been done by the team of the New Horizons. That image that's available this morning is absolutely stunning and spectacular, and it's unbelievable. It's so exciting. But, it takes about 5 hours for one-way communication with that machine, so we're going to have to wait a while.
Yeah, I understand we won't see it till probably about 6 o'clock Pacific time tonight. Some of this stuff.
It went through, and there may be debris in the way as it goes through that little system. So hopefully it survived.
Okay, it's an exciting universe. Thanks for talking to us today about antimatter. Dr. Jim Brow is director at the Oregon Center for High Energy Physics. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. See you later.
Take care.